In early times, every free Greek had had the opportunity of adventure. Philip and Alexander put an end to this state of affairs, and in the Hellenistic world only Macedonian dynasts enjoyed anarchic freedom. The Greek world lost its youth and became either cynical or religious. The hope of embodying ideals in earthly institutions faded, and with it the best men lost their zest. Heaven for Socrates was a place where he could go on arguing. For philosophers after Alexander, it was something more different from their existence here below. In Rome, a similar development came later, and in a less painful form. Rome was not conquered, as Greece was, but had, on the contrary, the stimulus of successful imperialism. Throughout the period of the civil wars, it was Romans who were responsible for the disorders. The Greeks had not secured peace and order by submitting to the Macedonians, whereas both Greeks and Romans secured both by submitting to Augustus. Augustus was a Roman to whom most Romans submitted willingly, not only on account of his superior power. Moreover, he took pains to disguise the military origin of his government and to base it upon decrees of the Senate. The adulation expressed by the Senate was, no doubt, largely insincere, but outside the senatorial class no one felt humiliated. The mood of the Romans was like that of a jeune homme rangé in 19th-century France, who, after a life of amatory adventure, settles down to a marriage of reason. This mood, though contented, is not creative. The great poets of the Augustan age had been formed in more troubled times. Horace fled at Philippi, and both he and Virgil lost their farms in confiscations for the benefit of victorious soldiers. Augustus, for the sake of stability, set to work, somewhat insincerely, to restore ancient piety, and was therefore necessarily rather hostile to free inquiry. The Roman world began to become stereotyped, and the process continued under later emperors. The immediate successors of Augustus indulged in appalling cruelties towards senators and towards possible competitors for the purple. To some extent, the misgovernment of this period extended to the provinces, but in the main the administrative machine created by Augustus continued to function fairly well. A better period began with the accession of Trajan in AD 98, and continued until the death of Marcus Aurelius in AD 180. During this time, the government of the empire was as good as any despotic government can be. The third century, on the contrary, was one of appalling disaster. The army realized its power, made and unmade emperors in return for cash and the promise of a life without warfare, and ceased in consequence to be an effective fighting force. The barbarians, from north and east, invaded and plundered Roman territory. The army, preoccupied with private gain and civil discord, was incompetent in defense. The whole fiscal system broke down, since there was an immense diminution of resources and at the same time a vast increase of expenditure in unsuccessful war and in bribery of the army. Pestilence, in addition to war, greatly diminished the population. It seemed as if the empire was about to fall. This result was averted by two energetic men, Diocletian, AD 286 to 305, and Constantine, whose undisputed reign lasted from AD 312 to 337. By then, the empire was divided into an eastern and a western half, corresponding approximately to the division between the Greek and Latin languages. By Constantine, the capital of the eastern half was established at Byzantium, to which he gave the new name of Constantinople. Diocletian curbed the army for a while by altering its character. From his time onwards, the most effective fighting forces were composed of barbarians, chiefly German, to whom all the highest commands were open. This was obviously a dangerous expedient, and early in the 5th century it bore its natural fruit. The barbarians decided that it was more profitable to fight for themselves than for a Roman master. Nevertheless, it served its purpose for over a century. Diocletian's administrative reforms were equally successful for a time, and equally disastrous in the long run. The Roman system was to allow local self-government to the towns, and to leave their officials to collect the taxes, of which only the total amount due from any one town was fixed by the central authorities. This system had worked well enough in prosperous times, but now, in the exhausted state of the empire, the revenue demanded was more than could be borne without excessive hardship. The municipal authorities were personally responsible for the taxes, and fled to escape payment. Diocletian compelled well-to-do citizens to accept municipal office and made flight illegal. From similar motives, he turned the rural population into serfs, tied to the soil and forbidden to migrate. This system was kept on by later emperors. Constantine's most important innovation was the adoption of Christianity as the state religion, apparently because a large proportion of the soldiers were Christian. The result of this was that when, during the 5th century, the Germans destroyed the Western Empire, its prestige caused them to adopt the Christian religion, thereby preserving for Western Europe so much of ancient civilization as had been absorbed by the Church. The development of the territory assigned to the eastern half of the empire was different. The Eastern Empire, though continually diminishing in extent, except for the transient conquests of Justinian in the 6th century, survived until 1453, when Constantinople was conquered by the Turks. But most of what had been Roman provinces in the east, including also Africa and Spain in the west, became Mohammedan. The Arabs, unlike the Germans, rejected the religion but adopted the civilization of those whom they had conquered. The Eastern Empire was Greek, not Latin, in its civilization. Accordingly, from the 7th to the 11th centuries, it was the Arabs who preserved Greek literature, and whatever survived of Greek as opposed to Latin civilization. From the 11th century onward, at first through Moorish influences, the West gradually recovered what it had lost of the Grecian heritage. I come now to the four ways in which the Roman Empire affected the history of culture. 1. The direct effect of Rome on Greek thought. This begins in the 2nd century BC, with two men, the historian Polybius and the Stoic philosopher Panaetius. The natural attitude of the Greek to the Roman was one of contempt mingled with fear. The Greek felt himself more civilized, but politically less powerful. If the Romans were more successful in politics, that only showed that politics is an ignoble pursuit. The average Greek of the 2nd century BC was pleasure-loving, quick-witted, clever in business, and unscrupulous in all things. There were, however, still men of philosophic capacity. Some of these, notably the skeptics, such as Carneades, had allowed cleverness to destroy seriousness. Some, like the Epicureans and a section of the Stoics, had withdrawn wholly into a quiet private life. But a few, with more insight than had been shown by Aristotle in relation to Alexander, realized that the greatness of Rome was due to certain merits which were lacking among the Greeks. The historian Polybius, born in Arcadia about 200 BC, was sent to Rome as a prisoner, and there had the good fortune to become the friend of the younger Scipio, whom he accompanied on many of his campaigns. It was uncommon for a Greek to know Latin, though most educated Romans knew Greek. The circumstances of Polybius, however, led him to a thorough familiarity with Latin. He wrote, for the benefit of the Greeks, the history of the Punic Wars, which had enabled Rome to conquer the world. His admiration of the Roman constitution was becoming out of date while he wrote, but until his time it had compared very favorably in stability and efficiency with the continually changing constitutions of most Greek cities. The Romans naturally read his history with pleasure. Whether the Greeks did so is more doubtful. Panaetius the Stoic has been already considered in the preceding chapter. He was a friend of Polybius, and like him, a protege of the younger Scipio. While Scipio lived, he was frequently in Rome, but after Scipio's death in 129 BC, he stayed in Athens as head of the Stoic school. Rome still had, what Greece had lost, the hopefulness connected with the opportunity for political activity. Accordingly, the doctrines of Panaetius were more political and less akin to those of the Cynics than were those of earlier Stoics. Probably the admiration of Plato felt by cultivated Romans influenced him in abandoning the dogmatic narrowness of his Stoic predecessors. In the broader form given to it by him and by his successor, Posidonius, Stoicism strongly appealed to the more serious among the Romans. At a later date, Epictetus, though a Greek, lived most of his life in Rome. Rome supplied him with most of his illustrations. He is always exhorting the wise man not to tremble in the presence of the emperor. We know the influence of Epictetus on Marcus Aurelius, but his influence on the Greeks is hard to trace. Plutarch, circa AD 46 to 120, in his Lives of the Noble Grecians and Romans, traced a parallelism between the most eminent men of the two countries. He spent a considerable time in Rome and was honored by the emperors Hadrian and Trajan. In addition to his lives, he wrote numerous works on philosophy, religion, natural history, and morals. His lives are obviously concerned to reconcile Greece and Rome in man's thoughts. On the whole, apart from such exceptional men, Rome acted as a blight on the Greek-speaking part of the empire. Thought and art alike declined. Until the end of the 2nd century AD, life for the well-to-do was pleasant and easygoing. There was no incentive to strenuousness and little opportunity for great achievement. The recognized schools of philosophy, the Academy, the Peripatetics, the Epicureans, and the Stoics, continued to exist until they were closed by Justinian, from Christian bigotry, in the year AD 529. None of these, however, showed any vitality throughout the time after Marcus Aurelius, except the Neoplatonists in the 3rd century AD, whom we shall consider in the next chapter, and these men were hardly at all influenced by Rome. The Latin and Greek halves of the empire became more and more divergent. The knowledge of Greek became rare in the West, and after Constantine, Latin in the East survived only in law and in the army. 2. The influence of Greece and the East in Rome. There are here two very different things to consider. First, the influence of Hellenic art and literature and philosophy on the most cultivated Romans. Second, the spread of non-Hellenic religions and superstitions throughout the Western world. 1. When the Romans first came in contact with Greeks, they became aware of themselves as comparatively barbarous and uncouth. The Greeks were immeasurably their superiors in many ways, in manufacture and in the technique of agriculture, in the kinds of knowledge that are necessary for a good official, in conversation and the art of enjoying life, in art and literature and philosophy. The only things in which the Romans were superior were military tactics and social cohesion. The relation of the Romans to the Greeks was something like that of the Prussians to the French in 1814 and 1815, but this latter was temporary, whereas the other lasted a long time. After the Punic Wars, young Romans conceived an admiration for the Greeks. They learnt the Greek language, they copied Greek architecture, they employed Greek sculptors. The Roman gods were identified with the gods of Greece. The Trojan origin of the Romans was invented to make a connection with the Homeric myths. Latin poets adopted Greek meters. Latin philosophers took over Greek theories. To the end, Rome was culturally parasitic on Greece. The Romans invented no art forms, constructed no original system of philosophy, and made no scientific discoveries. They made good roads, systematic legal codes, and efficient armies. For the rest, they looked to Greece. The Hellenizing of Rome brought with it a certain softening of manners, abhorrent to the elder Cato. Until the Punic Wars, the Romans had been a bucolic people, with the virtues and vices of farmers, austere, industrious, brutal, obstinate, and stupid. Their family life had been stable and solidly built on the patria potestas. Women and young people were completely subordinated. All this changed with the influx of sudden wealth. The small farms disappeared and were gradually replaced by huge estates on which slave labor was employed to carry out new scientific kinds of agriculture. A great class of traders grew up, and a large number of men enriched by plunder, like the nabobs in 18th century England. Women, who had been virtuous slaves, became free and dissolute. Divorce became common. The rich ceased to have children. the Greeks, who had gone through a similar development centuries ago, encouraged by their example what historians call the decay of morals. Even in the most dissolute times of the empire, the average Roman still thought of Rome as the upholder of a purer ethical standard against the decadent corruption of Greece. The cultural influence of Greece on the Western Empire diminished rapidly from the 3rd century AD onwards, chiefly because culture in general decayed. For this, there were many causes, but one in particular must be mentioned. In the last times of the Western Empire, the government was more undisguisedly a military tyranny than it had been, and the army usually selected a successful general as emperor. But the army, even in its highest ranks, was no longer composed of cultivated Romans, but of semi-barbarians from the frontier. These rough soldiers had no use for culture and regarded the civilized citizens solely as sources of revenue. Private persons were too impoverished to support much in the way of education, and the state considered education unnecessary. Consequently, in the West, only a few men of exceptional learning continued to read Greek. 2. Non-Hellenic religion and superstition, on the contrary, acquired, as time went on, a firmer and firmer hold on the West. We have already seen how Alexander's conquests introduced the Greek world to the beliefs of Babylonians, Persians, and Egyptians. Similarly, the Roman conquests made the Western world familiar with these doctrines and also with those of Jews and Christians. I shall consider what concerns the Jews and Christians at a later stage. For the present, I shall confine myself as far as possible to pagan superstitions. In Rome, every sect and every prophet was represented, and sometimes won favor in the highest government circles. Lucian, who stood for sane skepticism in spite of the credulity of his age, tells an amusing story, generally accepted as broadly true, about a prophet and miracle worker called Alexander the Paphlagonian. This man healed the sick and foretold the future, with excursions into blackmail. His fame reached the ears of Marcus Aurelius, then fighting the Marcomanni on the Danube. The emperor consulted him as to how to win the war, and was told that if he threw two lions into the Danube, a great victory would result. He followed the advice of the seer, but it was the Marcomanni who won the great victory. In spite of this mishap, Alexander's fame continued to grow. A prominent Roman of consular rank, Rutilianus, after consulting him on many points, at last sought his advice as to the choice of a wife. Alexander, like Endymion, had enjoyed the favours of the moon, and by her had a daughter whom the oracle recommended to Rutilianus. Rutilianus, who was at the time 60 years old, at once complied with the divine injunction and celebrated his marriage by sacrificing whole hecatombs to his celestial mother-in-law. More important than the career of Alexander the Paphlagonian was the reign of the emperor Elagabalus, or Heliogabalus, AD 218 to 22, who was, until his elevation by the choice of the army, a Syrian priest of the sun. In his slow progress from Syria to Rome, he was preceded by his portrait, sent as a present to the Senate. He was drawn in his sacerdotal robes of silk and gold, after the loose, flowing fashion of the Medes and Phoenicians. His head was covered with a lofty tiara. His numerous collars and bracelets were adorned with gems of inestimable value. His eyebrows were tinged with black, and his cheeks painted with an artificial red and white. The grave senators confessed with a sigh that after having long experienced the stern tyranny of their own countrymen, Rome was at length humbled beneath the effeminate luxury of Oriental despotism. Supported by a large section in the army, he proceeded with fanatical zeal to introduce in Rome the religious practices of the East. His name was that of the sun god, worshipped at Emesa, where he had been chief priest. His mother or grandmother, who was the real ruler, perceived that he had gone too far and deposed him in favour of her nephew Alexander, 222-35, whose Oriental proclivities were more moderate. The mixture of creeds that was possible in his day was illustrated in his private chapel, in which he placed the statues of Abraham, Orpheus, Apollonius of Tyana, and Christ. The religion of Mithras, which was of Persian origin, was a close competitor of Christianity, especially during the latter half of the 3rd century AD. The emperors, who were making desperate attempts to control the army, felt that religion might give a much-needed stability. But it would have to be one of the new religions, since it was these that the soldiers favored. The cult was introduced at Rome and had much to commend it to the military mind. Mithras was a sun god, but not so effeminate as his Syrian colleague. He was a god concerned with war, the great war between good and evil, which had been part of the Persian creed since Zoroaster. Rostovtsev reproduces a bas-relief representing his worship, which was found in a subterranean sanctuary at Heddenheim in Germany, and shows that his disciples must have been numerous among the soldiers, not only in the East, but in the West also. Constantine's adoption of Christianity was politically successful, whereas early attempts to introduce a new religion failed. But the earlier attempts were, from a governmental point of view, very similar to his. All alike derived their possibility of success from the misfortunes and weariness of the Roman world. The traditional religions of Greece and Rome were suited to men interested in the terrestrial world and hopeful of happiness on earth. Asia, with a longer experience of despair, had evolved more successful antidotes in the form of otherworldly hopes. Of all these, Christianity was the most effective in bringing consolation. But Christianity, by the time it became the state religion, had absorbed much from Greece and transmitted this, along with the Judaic element, to succeeding ages in the West. 3. The unification of government and culture. We owe it first to Alexander and then to Rome that the achievements of the great age of Greece were not lost to the world, like those of the Minoan age. In the 5th century BC, a Genghis Khan, if one had happened to arise, could have wiped out all that was important in the Hellenic world. Xerxes, with a little more confidence, might have made Greek civilization very greatly inferior to what it became after he was repulsed. Consider the period from Aeschylus to Plato. All that was done in this time was done by a minority of the population of a few commercial cities. These cities, as the future showed, had no great capacity for withstanding foreign conquest. But by an extraordinary stroke of good fortune, their conquerors, Macedonian and Roman, were Philhellenes, and did not destroy what they conquered, as Xerxes or Carthage would have done. The fact that we are acquainted with what was done by the Greeks in art and literature and philosophy and science is due to the stability introduced by Western conquerors who had the good sense to admire the civilization which they governed, but did their utmost to preserve. In certain respects, political and ethical, Alexander and the Romans were the causes of a better philosophy than any that was professed by Greeks in their days of freedom. The Stoics, as we have seen, believed in the brotherhood of man and did not confine their sympathies to the Greeks. The long dominion of Rome accustomed men to the idea of a single civilization under a single government. We are aware that there were important parts of the world which were not subject to Rome, India and China more especially. But to the Roman, it seemed that outside the empire there were only obscure barbarian tribes who might be conquered whenever it should be worthwhile to make the effort. Essentially, and in idea, the empire in the minds of the Romans was worldwide. This conception descended to the church, which was Catholic, in spite of Buddhists, Confucians, and later Mohammedans. Securus judicat orbis terrarum is a maxim taken over by the church from the later Stoics. It owes its appeal to the apparent universality of the Roman Empire. Throughout the Middle Ages, after the time of Charlemagne, the Church and the Holy Roman Empire were worldwide in idea, although everybody knew that they were not so in fact. The conception of one human family, one Catholic religion, one universal culture, and one worldwide state has haunted men's thoughts ever since its approximate realization by Rome. The part played by Rome in enlarging the area of civilization was of immense importance. Northern Italy, Spain, France, and parts of Western Germany were civilized as a result of forcible conquest by the Roman legions. All these regions proved themselves just as capable of a high level of culture as Rome itself. In the last days of the Western Empire, Gaul produced men who were at least the equals of their contemporaries in regions of older civilization. It was owing to the diffusion of culture by Rome that the barbarians produced only a temporary eclipse, not a permanent darkness. It may be argued that the quality of civilization was never again as good as in the Athens of Pericles, but in a world of war and destruction, quantity is, in the long run, almost as important as quality, and quantity was due to Rome. 4. The Mohammedans as vehicles of Hellenism. In the 7th century, the disciples of the Prophet conquered Syria, Egypt, and North Africa. In the following century, they conquered Spain. Their victories were easy, and the fighting was slight. Except possibly during the first few years, they were not fanatical. Christians and Jews were unmolested so long as they paid the tribute. Very soon, the Arabs acquired the civilization of the Eastern Empire, but with the hopefulness of a rising polity instead of the weariness of decline. Their learned men read Greek and wrote commentaries. Aristotle's reputation is mainly due to them. In antiquity, he was seldom mentioned and was not regarded as on a level with Plato. It is instructive to consider some of the words that we derive from Arabic, such as algebra, alcohol, alchemy, alembic, alkali, azimuth, zenith. With the exception of alcohol, which meant not a drink, but a substance used in chemistry, these words would give a good picture of some of the things we owe to the Arabs. Algebra had been invented by the Alexandrian Greeks, but was carried further by the Mohammedans. Alchemy, alembic, alkali are words connected with the attempt to turn base metals into gold, which the Arabs took over from the Greeks, and in pursuit of which they appealed to Greek philosophy. Azimuth and zenith are astronomical terms, chiefly useful to the Arabs in connection with astrology. The etymological method conceals what we owe to the Arabs as regards knowledge of Greek philosophy, because when it was again studied in Europe, the technical terms required were taken from Greek or Latin. In philosophy, the Arabs were better as commentators than as original thinkers. Their importance for us is that they, and not the Christians, were the immediate inheritors of those parts of the Greek tradition which only the Eastern Empire had kept alive. Contact with the Mohammedans in Spain, and to a lesser extent in Sicily, made the West aware of Aristotle, also of Arabic numerals, algebra, and chemistry. It was this contact that began the revival of learning in the 11th century, leading to the scholastic philosophy. It was much later, from the 13th century onward, that the study of Greek enabled men to go direct to the words of Plato and Aristotle, and other Greek writers of antiquity. But if the Arabs had not preserved the tradition, the men of the Renaissance might not have suspected how much was to be gained by the revival of classical learning. Chapter 30. Plotinus. Plotinus, AD 204 to 270, the founder of Neoplatonism, is the last of the great philosophers of antiquity. His life is almost coextensive with one of the most disastrous periods in Roman history. Shortly before his birth, the army had become conscious of its power and had adopted the practice of choosing emperors in return for monetary rewards and assassinating them afterwards to give occasion for a renewed sale of the empire. These preoccupations unfitted the soldiers for the defense of the frontier and permitted vigorous incursions of Germans from the north and Persians from the east. War and pestilence diminished the population of the empire by about a third, while increased taxation and diminished resources caused financial ruin in even those provinces to which no hostile forces penetrated. The cities, which had been the bearers of culture, were especially hard hit. Substantial citizens in large numbers fled to escape the tax collector. It was not till after the death of Plotinus that order was re-established and the empire temporarily saved by the vigorous measures of Diocletian and Constantine. Of all this, there is no mention in the works of Plotinus. He turned aside from the spectacle of ruin and misery in the actual world to contemplate an eternal world of goodness and beauty. In this, he was in harmony with all the most serious men of his age. To all of them, Christians and pagans alike, the world of practical affairs seemed to offer no hope, and only the other world seemed worthy of allegiance. To the Christian, the other world was the kingdom of heaven, to be enjoyed after death. To the Platonist, it was the eternal world of ideas, the real world as opposed to that of illusory appearance. Christian theologians combined these points of view and embodied much of the philosophy of Plotinus. Dean Ing, in his invaluable book on Plotinus, rightly emphasizes what Christianity owes to him. Platonism, he says, is part of the vital structure of Christian theology with which no other philosophy, I venture to say, can work without friction. There is, he says, an utter impossibility of excising Platonism from Christianity without tearing Christianity to pieces. He points out that St. Augustine speaks of Plato's system as the most pure and bright in all philosophy, and of Plotinus as a man in whom Plato lived again, and who, if he had lived a little later, would have changed a few words and phrases and become Christian. St. Thomas Aquinas, according to Dean Ing, is nearer to Plotinus than to the real Aristotle. Plotinus, accordingly, is historically important as an influence in moulding the Christianity of the Middle Ages and of Catholic theology. The historian, in speaking of Christianity, has to be careful to recognize the very great changes that it has undergone, and the variety of forms that it may assume even at one epoch. The Christianity of the Synoptic Gospels is almost innocent of metaphysics. The Christianity of modern America, in this respect, is like primitive Christianity. Platonism is alien to popular thought and feeling in the United States, and most American Christians are much more concerned with duties here on earth and with social progress in the everyday world than with the transcendental hopes that consoled men when everything terrestrial inspired despair. I am not speaking of any change of dogma, but of a difference of emphasis and interest. A modern Christian, unless he realizes how great this difference is, will fail to understand the Christianity of the past. We, since our study is historical, are concerned with the effective beliefs of past centuries, and as to these it is impossible to disagree with what Dean Ing says on the influence of Plato and Plotinus. Plotinus, however, is not only historically important. He represents, better than any other philosopher, an important type of theory. A philosophical system may be judged important for various different kinds of reasons. The first and most obvious is that we think it may be true. Not many students of philosophy at the present time would feel this about Plotinus. Dean Ing is, in this respect, a rare exception. But truth is not the only merit that a metaphysic can possess. It may have beauty, and this is certainly to be found in Plotinus. There are passages that remind one of the later cantos of Dante's Paradiso, and of almost nothing else in literature. Now and again, his descriptions of the eternal world of glory. To our high-wrought fantasy present that undisturbed song of pure consent, I sung before the sapphire-colored throne to him that sits thereon. Again, a philosophy may be important because it expresses well what men are prone to believe in certain moods or in certain circumstances. Uncomplicated joy and sorrow is not matter for philosophy, but rather for the simpler kinds of poetry and music. Only joy and sorrow accompanied by reflection on the universe generate metaphysical theories. A man may be a cheerful pessimist or a melancholy optimist. Perhaps Samuel Butler may serve as an example of the first. Plotinus is an admirable example of the second. In an age such as that in which he lived, unhappiness is immediate and pressing, whereas happiness, if attainable at all, must be sought by reflection upon things that are remote from the impressions of sense. Such happiness has in it always an element of strain. It is very unlike the simple happiness of a child. And since it is not derived from the everyday world, but from thought and imagination, it demands a power of ignoring or despising the life of the senses. It is, therefore, not those who enjoy instinctive happiness who invent the kinds of metaphysical optimism that depend upon belief in the reality of a supersensible world. Among the men who have been unhappy in a mundane sense, but resolutely determined to find a higher happiness in the world of theory, Plotinus holds a very high place. Nor are his purely intellectual merits by any means to be despised. He has, in many respects, clarified Plato's teaching. He has developed, with as much consistency as possible, the type of theory advocated by him in common with many others. His arguments against materialism are good, and his whole conception of the relation of soul and body is clearer than that of Plato or Aristotle. Like Spinoza, he has a certain kind of moral purity and loftiness, which is very impressive. He is always sincere, never shrill or censorious, invariably concerned to tell the reader as simply as he can what he believes to be important. Whatever one may think of him as a theoretical philosopher, it is impossible not to love him as a man. The life of Plotinus is known, so far as it is known, through the biography written by his friend and disciple Porphyry, a Semite whose real name was Malchus. There are, however, miraculous elements in this account which make it difficult to place a complete reliance upon its more credible portions. Plotinus considered his spatio-temporal appearance unimportant, and was loath to talk about the accidents of his historical existence. He stated, however, that he was born in Egypt, and it is known that as a young man he studied in Alexandria, where he lived until the age of 39, and where his teacher was Ammonius Saccas, often regarded as the founder of Neoplatonism. He then joined the expedition of the Emperor Gordian III against the Persians, with the intention, it is said, of studying the religions of the East. The emperor was still a youth and was murdered by the army, as was at that time the custom. This occurred during his campaign in Mesopotamia in AD 244. Plotinus thereupon abandoned his Oriental projects and settled in Rome, where he soon began to teach. Among his hearers were many influential men, and he was favored by the emperor Gallienus. Footnote. Concerning Gallienus, Gibbon remarks, "He was a master of several curious but useless sciences, a ready orator and an elegant poet, a skillful gardener, an excellent cook, a most contemptible prince. When the great emergencies of the state required his presence and attention, he was engaged in conversation with the philosopher Plotinus, wasting his time in trifling or licentious pleasures, preparing his initiation to the Grecian mysteries, or soliciting a place in the Areopagus of Athens." End of footnote. At one time, he formed a project of founding Plato's Republic in the Campania, and building for the purpose a new city to be called Platonopolis. The emperor at first was favorable, but ultimately withdrew his permission. It may seem strange that there should be room for a new city so near Rome, but probably by that time the region was malarial, as it is now, but had not been earlier. He wrote nothing until the age of 49. After that, he wrote much. His works were edited and arranged by Porphyry, who was more Pythagorean than Plotinus, and caused the Neoplatonist school to become more supernaturalist than it would have been if it had followed Plotinus more faithfully. The respect of Plotinus for Plato is very great. Plato is usually alluded to as he. In general, the blessed ancients are treated with reverence, but this reverence does not extend to the atomists. The Stoics and Epicureans, being still active, are controverted. The Stoics only for their materialism, the Epicureans for every part of their philosophy. Aristotle plays a larger part than appears, as borrowings from him are often unacknowledged. One feels the influence of Parmenides at many points. The Plato of Plotinus is not so full-blooded as the real Plato. The theory of ideas, the mystical doctrines of the Phaedo and of Book 6 of the Republic, and the discussion of love in the Symposium, make up almost the whole of Plato as he appears in the Enneads, as the books of Plotinus are called. The political interests, the search for definitions of separate virtues, the pleasure in mathematics, the dramatic and affectionate appreciation of individuals, and above all the playfulness of Plato, are wholly absent from Plotinus. Plato, as Carlyle said, is very much at his ease in Zion. Plotinus, on the contrary, is always on his best behavior. The metaphysics of Plotinus begins with a holy trinity, the one, spirit, and soul. These three are not equal like the persons of the Christian Trinity, The One is supreme, Spirit comes next, and Soul last. Footnote. Origen, who was a contemporary of Plotinus and had the same teacher in philosophy, taught that the first person was superior to the second and the second to the third, agreeing in this with Plotinus. But Origen's view was subsequently declared heretical. End of footnote. The One is somewhat shadowy. It is sometimes called God, sometimes the Good. It transcends being, which is the first sequent upon the One. We must not attribute predicates to it, but only say it is. This is reminiscent of Parmenides. It would be a mistake to speak of God as the All, because God transcends the All. God is present through all things. The One can be present without any coming. While it is nowhere, nowhere is it not. Although the One is sometimes spoken of as the Good, we are also told that it precedes both the good and the beautiful. Sometimes the One appears to resemble Aristotle's God. We are told that God has no need of his derivatives and ignores the created world. The One is indefinable, and in regard to it, there is more truth in silence than in any words whatever. We now come to the second person, whom Plotinus calls nous. It is always difficult to find an English word to represent nous. The standard dictionary translation is mind, but this does not have the correct connotations, particularly when the word is used in religious philosophy. If we were to say that Plotinus put mind above soul, we should give a completely wrong impression. McKenna, the translator of Plotinus, uses intellectual principle, but this is awkward and does not suggest an object suitable for religious veneration. Dean Ing uses spirit, which is perhaps the best word available, but it leaves out the intellectual element which was important in all Greek religious philosophy after Pythagoras. Mathematics, the world of ideas and all thought about what is not sensible, have, for Pythagoras, Plato, and Plotinus, something divine. They constitute the activity of nous, or at least the nearest approach to its activity that we can conceive. It was this intellectual element in Plato's religion that led Christians, notably the author of St. John's Gospel, to identify Christ with the Logos. Logos should be translated reason in this connection. This prevents us from using reason as the translation of nous. I shall follow Dean Ing in using spirit, but with the proviso that nous has an intellectual connotation which is absent from spirit as usually understood. But often I shall use the word nous untranslated. Nous, we are told, is the image of the One. It is engendered because the One, in its self-quest, has vision. This seeing is nous. This is a difficult conception. A being without parts, Plotinus says, may know itself. In this case, the seer and the seen are one. In God, who is conceived as by Plato on the analogy of the sun, the light giver and what is lit are the same. Pursuing the analogy, nous may be considered as the light by which the One sees itself. It is possible for us to know the divine mind, which we forget through self-will. To know the divine mind, we must study our own soul when it is most godlike. We must put aside the body and the part of the soul that molded the body, and sense with desires and impulses and every such futility. What is then left is an image of the divine intellect. Those divinely possessed and inspired have at least the knowledge that they hold some greater thing within them, though they cannot tell what it is. From the movements that stir them and the utterances that come from them, they perceive the power, not themselves, that moves them. In the same way it must be, we stand towards the supreme when we hold nous pure. We know the divine mind within, that which gives being and all else of that order. But we know, too, that other. Know that it is none of these, but a nobler principle than anything we know as being, fuller and greater, above reason, mind, and feeling, conferring these powers not to be confounded with them. Thus, when we are divinely possessed and inspired, we see not only nous, but also the One. When we are thus in contact with the divine, we cannot reason or express the vision in words. This comes later. At the moment of touch, there is no power whatever to make any affirmation. There is no leisure. Reasoning upon the vision is for afterwards. We may know we have had the vision when the soul has suddenly taken light. This light is from the Supreme and is the Supreme. We may believe in the presence when, like that other God on the call of a certain man, he comes bringing light. The light is the proof of the advent. Thus, the soul unlit remains without that vision. Lit, it possesses what it sought. And this is the true end set before the soul to take that light, to see the Supreme by the Supreme and not by the light of any other principle, to see the Supreme which is also the means to the vision. For that which illumines the soul is that which it is to see just as it is by the sun's own light that we see the sun. But how is this to be accomplished? Cut away everything. The experience of ecstasy, standing outside one's own body, happened frequently to Plotinus. Many times it has happened, lifted out of the body into myself, becoming external to all other things and self-centered, beholding a marvelous beauty, then more than ever assured of community with the loftiest order, enacting the noblest life, acquiring identity with the divine, stationing within it by having attained that activity, poised above whatsoever in the intellectual is less than the supreme. Yet there comes the moment of descent from intellection to reasoning, and after that, sojourn in the divine. I ask myself how it happens that I can now be descending, and how did the soul ever enter into my body? The soul which even within the body is the high thing it has shown itself to be. This brings us to soul, the third and lowest member of the Trinity. Soul, though inferior to nous, the author of all living things, it made the sun and moon and stars and the whole visible world. It is the offspring of the divine intellect. It is double. There is an inner soul, intent on nous, and another which faces the external. The latter is associated with a downward movement in which the soul generates its image, which is nature and the world of sense. The Stoics had identified nature with God, but Plotinus regards it as the lowest sphere, something emanating from the soul when it forgets to look upward towards nous. This might suggest the Gnostic view that the visible world is evil, but Plotinus does not take this view. The visible world is beautiful and is the abode of blessed spirits. It is only less good than the intellectual world. In a very interesting, controversial discussion of the Gnostic view that the cosmos and its creator are evil, he admits that some parts of Gnostic doctrine, such as the hatred of matter, may be due to Plato, but holds that the other parts, which do not come from Plato, are untrue. His objections to Gnosticism are of two sorts. On the one hand, he says that soul, when it creates the material world, does so from memory of the divine, and not because it is fallen. The world of sense, he thinks, is as good as a sensible world can be. He feels strongly the beauty of things perceived by the senses. Who that truly perceives the harmony of the intellectual realm could fail, if he has any bent towards music, to answer to the harmony in sensible sounds? What geometrician or arithmetician could fail to take pleasure in the symmetries, correspondences, and principles of order observed in visible things? Consider even the case of pictures. Those seeing by the bodily sense the productions of the art of painting do not see the one thing in the one only way. They are deeply stirred by recognizing in the objects depicted to the eyes the presentation of what lies in the idea, and so are called to recollection of the truth, the very experience out of which love rises. Now, if the sight of beauty, excellently reproduced upon a face, hurries the mind to that other sphere, surely no one seeing the loveliness lavish in the world of sense, this vast orderliness, the form which the stars even in their remoteness display, no one could be so dull-witted, so immovable, as not to be carried by all this to recollection, and gripped by reverent awe in the thought of all this so great sprung from that greatness. Not to answer thus could only be to have neither fathomed this world nor had any vision of that other. There is another reason for rejecting the Gnostic view. The Gnostics think that nothing divine is associated with the sun, moon, and stars. They were created by an evil spirit. Only the soul of man, among things perceived, has any goodness. But Plotinus is firmly persuaded that the heavenly bodies are the bodies of godlike beings, immeasurably superior to man. According to the Gnostics, their own soul, the soul of the least of mankind, they declare deathless, divine. But the entire heavens and the stars within the heavens have had no communion with the immortal principle, though these are far purer and lovelier than their own souls. For the view of Plotinus, there is an authority in the Timaeus, and it was adopted by some Christian fathers, for instance, Origen. It is imaginatively attractive. It expresses feelings that the heavenly bodies naturally inspire and makes man less lonely in the physical universe. There is in the mysticism of Plotinus nothing morose or hostile to beauty, but he is the last religious teacher for many centuries of whom this can be said. Beauty, and all the pleasures associated with it, came to be thought to be of the devil. Pagans, as well as Christians, came to glorify ugliness and dirt. Julian, the apostle,
confided to Ward, "I must tell Charles to prune it,"
of the populousness of his beard. Of all this, there is nothing in Plotinus. Matter is created by soul, and has no independent reality. Every soul has its hour. When that strikes, it descends and enters the body suitable to it. The motive is not reason, but something more analogous to sexual desire. When the soul leaves the body, it must enter another body if it has been sinful, for justice requires that it should be punished. If in this life you have murdered your mother, you will in the next life be a woman and be murdered by your son. Sin must be punished, but the punishment happens naturally, through the restless driving of the sinner's errors. Do we remember this life after we are dead? The answer is perfectly logical, but not what most modern theologians would say. Memory is concerned with our life in time, whereas our best and truest life is in eternity. Therefore, as the soul grows towards eternal life, it will remember less and less. Friends, children, wife, will be gradually forgotten. Ultimately, we shall know nothing of the things of this world, but only contemplate the intellectual realm. There will be no memory of personality which, in contemplative vision, is unaware of itself. The soul will become one with nous, but not to its own destruction. Nous and the individual soul will be simultaneously two and one. In the fourth Ennead, which is On the Soul, one section, the seventh tractate, is devoted to the discussion of immortality. The body, being compound, is clearly not immortal. If, then, it is part of us, we are not wholly immortal. But what is the relation of the soul to the body? Aristotle, who is not mentioned explicitly, said the soul was the form of the body. But Plotinus rejects this view on the ground that the intellectual act would be impossible if the soul were any form of body. The Stoics think that the soul is material, but the unity of the soul proves that this is impossible. Moreover, since matter is passive, it cannot have created itself. Matter could not exist if soul had not created it, and if soul did not exist, matter would disappear in a twinkling. The soul is neither matter nor the form of a material body, but essence, and essence is eternal. This view is implicit in Plato's argument that the soul is immortal because ideas are eternal, but it is only with Plotinus that it becomes explicit. How does the soul enter the body from the aloofness of the intellectual world? The answer is through appetite. But appetite, though sometimes ignoble, may be comparatively noble. At best, the soul has the desire of elaborating order on the model of what it has seen in the intellectual principle, nous. That is to say, soul contemplates the inward realm of essence and wishes to produce something as like it as possible that can be seen by looking without instead of looking within, like, we might say, a composer who first imagines his music and then wishes to hear it performed by an orchestra. But this desire of the soul to create has unfortunate results. So long as the soul lives in the pure world of essence, it is not separated from other souls living in the same world. But as soon as it becomes joined to a body, it has the task of governing what is lower than itself. And by this task, it becomes separate from other souls, which have other bodies. Except in a few men at a few moments, the soul becomes chained to the body. The body obscures the truth, but there all stands out clear and separate. Footnote: Plotinus habitually uses there as a Christian might, as it is used, for instance, in The Life That Knows No Ending, The Tearless Life Is There. End of footnote. This doctrine, like Plato's, has difficulty in avoiding the view that the creation was a mistake. The soul, at its best, is content with nous, the world of essence. If it were always at its best, it would not create, but only contemplate. It seems that the act of creation is to be excused on the ground that the created world, in its main lines, is the best that is logically possible. But this is a copy of the eternal world, and as such has the beauty that is possible to a copy. The most definite statement is in the Tractate on the Gnostics. To ask why the soul has created the cosmos is to ask why there is a soul and why a creator creates. The question also implies a beginning in the eternal, and further represents creation as the act of a changeful being who turns from this to that. Those that think so must be instructed, if they would but bear with correction, in the nature of the supernals, and brought to desist from that blasphemy of majestic powers which comes so easily to them where all should be reverent scruple. Even in the administration of the universe there is no ground for such attack, for it affords manifest proof of the greatness of the intellectual kind. This all that has emerged into life is no amorphous structure, like those lesser forms within it which are born night and day out of the lavishness of its vitality. The universe is a life organized, effective, complex, all-comprehensive, displaying an unfathomable wisdom. How then can anyone deny that it is a clear image, beautifully formed, of the intellectual divinities? No doubt it is a copy, not original, but that is its very nature. It cannot be at once symbol and reality. But to say that it is an inadequate copy is false. Nothing has been left out which a beautiful representation within the physical order could include. Such a reproduction there must necessarily be, though not by deliberation and contrivance, for the intellectual could not be the last of things, but must have a double act, one within itself and one outgoing. There must, then, be something later than the divine, for only the thing with which all power ends fails to pass downward something of itself. This is perhaps the best answer to the Gnostics that the principles of Plotinus make possible. The problem, in slightly different language, was inherited by Christian theologians. They also have found it difficult to account for the creation without allowing the blasphemous conclusion that, before it, something was lacking to the Creator. Indeed, their difficulty is greater than that of Plotinus, for he may say that the nature of mind made creation inevitable, whereas for the Christian, the world resulted from the untrammeled exercise of God's free will. Plotinus has a very vivid sense of a certain kind of abstract beauty. In describing the position of intellect as intermediate between the one and soul, he suddenly bursts out into a passage of rare eloquence. The supreme, in its progress, could never be borne forward upon some soulless vehicle, nor even directly upon the soul. It will be heralded by some ineffable beauty. Before the great king in his progress there comes first the minor train, then, rank by rank, the greater and more exalted. Closer to the king, the kinglier. Next, his own honored company, until, last among all these grandeurs, suddenly appears the supreme monarch himself. And all, unless indeed for those who have contented themselves with the spectacle before his coming and gone away, prostrate themselves and hail him. There is a tractate on intellectual beauty which shows the same kind of feeling. Assuredly, all the gods are august and beautiful in a beauty beyond our speech. And what makes them so? Intellect. And especially intellect operating within them, the divine sun and stars, to visibility. To live at ease is there. And to these divine beings, verity is mother and nurse, existence and sustenance. All that is not of process, but of authentic being they see, and themselves in all. For all is transparent, nothing dark, nothing resistant. Every being is lucid to every other in breadth and depth. Light runs through light. And each of them contains all within itself, and at the same time sees all in every other, so that everywhere there is all. And all is all, and each all, and infinite the glory. Each of them is great. The small is great. The sun, there, is all the stars. And every star, again, is all the stars and sun. While some manner of being is dominant in each, all are mirrored in every other. In addition to the imperfection which the world inevitably possesses because it is a copy, there is for Plotinus, as for the Christians, the more positive evil that results from sin. Sin is a consequence of free will, which Plotinus upholds as against the determinists, and more particularly the astrologers. He does not venture to deny the validity of astrology altogether, but he attempts to set bounds to it, so as to make what remains compatible with free will. He does the same as regards magic. The sage, he says, is exempt from the power of the magician. Porphyry relates that a rival philosopher tried to put evil spells on Plotinus, but that because of his holiness and wisdom, the spells recoiled on the rival. Porphyry and all the followers of Plotinus are much more superstitious than he is. Superstition in him is as slight as was possible in that age. Let us now endeavour to sum up the merits and defects of the doctrine taught by Plotinus, and in the main accept it by Christian theology so long as it remained systematic and intellectual. There is, first and foremost, the construction of what Plotinus believed to be a secure refuge for ideals and hopes, and one, moreover, which involved both moral and intellectual effort. In the 3rd century, and in the centuries after the barbarian invasion, Western civilization came near to total destruction. It was fortunate that, while theology was almost the sole surviving mental activity, the system that was accepted was not purely superstitious, but preserved, though sometimes deeply buried, doctrines which embodied much of the work of Greek intellect and much of the moral devotion that is common to the Stoics and the Neoplatonists. This made possible the rise of the scholastic philosophy, and later, with the Renaissance, the stimulus derived from the renewed study of Plato, and thence of the other ancients. On the other hand, the philosophy of Plotinus has the defect of encouraging men to look within rather than to look without. When we look within, we see nous, which is divine, while when we look without, we see the imperfections of the sensible world. This kind of subjectivity was a gradual growth. It is to be found in the doctrines of Protagoras, Socrates, and Plato, as well as in the Stoics and Epicureans. but at first it was only doctrinal, not temperamental. For a long time it failed to kill scientific curiosity. We saw how Posidonius, about 100 BC, travelled to Spain and the Atlantic coast of Africa to study the tides. Gradually, however, subjectivism invaded men's feelings as well as their doctrines. Science was no longer cultivated, and only virtue was thought important. Virtue, as conceived by Plato, involved all that was then possible in the way of mental achievement. But in later centuries, it came to be thought of, increasingly, as involving only the virtuous will, and not a desire to understand the physical world or improve the world of human institutions. Christianity, in its ethical doctrines, was not free from this defect, although in practice belief in the importance of spreading the Christian faith gave a practicable object for moral activity, which was no longer confined to the perfecting of self. Plotinus is both an end and a beginning. An end as regards the Greeks, a beginning as regards Christendom. To the ancient world, weary with centuries of disappointment, exhausted by despair, his doctrine might be acceptable, but could not be stimulating. To the cruder barbarian world, where superabundant energy needed to be restrained and regulated rather than stimulated, what could penetrate in his teaching was beneficial, since the evil to be combated was not languor, but brutality. The work of transmitting what could survive of his philosophy was performed by the Christian philosophers of the last age of Rome. Book 2. Catholic Philosophy. Introduction. Catholic philosophy, in the sense in which I shall use the term, is that which dominated European thought from Augustine to the Renaissance. There have been philosophers before and after this period of 10 centuries who belonged to the same general school. Before Augustine, there were the early fathers, especially Origen. After the Renaissance, there are many, including at the present day all Orthodox Catholic teachers of philosophy, who adhere to some medieval system, especially that of Thomas Aquinas. But it is only from Augustine to the Renaissance that the greatest philosophers of the age are concerned in building up or perfecting the Catholic synthesis. In the Christian centuries before Augustine, Stoics and Neoplatonists outshine the fathers in philosophic ability. After the Renaissance, none of the outstanding philosophers, even among those who were Orthodox Catholics, were concerned to carry on the scholastic or the Augustinian tradition. The period with which we shall be concerned in this book differs from earlier and later times not only in philosophy, but in many other ways. The most notable of these is the power of the Church. The Church brought philosophic beliefs into a closer relation to social and political circumstances than they have ever had before or since the medieval period, which we may reckon from about AD 400 to about AD 1400. The Church is a social institution built upon a creed, partly philosophic, partly concerned with sacred history. It achieved power and wealth by means of its creed. The lay rulers, who were in frequent conflict with it, were defeated because the great majority of the population, including most of the lay rulers themselves, were profoundly convinced of the truth of the Catholic faith. There were traditions, Roman and Germanic, against which the Church had to fight. The Roman tradition was strongest in Italy, especially among lawyers. The German tradition was strongest in the feudal aristocracy that arose out of the barbarian conquest. But for many centuries, neither of these traditions proved strong enough to generate a successful opposition to the Church. And this was largely due to the fact that they were not embodied in any adequate philosophy. A history of thought, such as that upon which we are engaged, is unavoidably one-sided in dealing with the Middle Ages. With very few exceptions, all the men of this period who contributed to the intellectual life of their time were churchmen. The laity in the Middle Ages slowly built up a vigorous political and economic system, but their activities were in a sense blind. There was, in the later Middle Ages, an important lay literature, very different from that of the Church. In a general history, this literature would demand more consideration than is called for in a history of philosophic thought. It is not until we come to Dante that we find a layman writing with full knowledge of the ecclesiastical philosophy of his time. Until the 14th century, ecclesiastics have a virtual monopoly of philosophy, and philosophy, accordingly, is written from the standpoint of the Church. For this reason, medieval thought cannot be made intelligible without a fairly extensive account of the growth of ecclesiastical institutions, and especially of the papacy. The medieval world, as contrasted with the world of antiquity, is characterized by various forms of dualism. There is the dualism of clergy and laity, the dualism of Latin and Teuton, the dualism of the kingdom of God and the kingdoms of this world, the dualism of the spirit and the flesh. All these are exemplified in the dualism of Pope and Emperor. The dualism of Latin and Teuton is an outcome of the barbarian invasion, but the others have older sources. The relations of clergy and laity for the Middle Ages were to be modelled on the relations of Samuel and Saul. The demand for the supremacy of the clergy arose out of the period of Arian or semi-Arian emperors and kings. The dualism of the kingdom of God and the kingdoms of this world is found in the New Testament, but was systematized in St. Augustine's City of God. The dualism of the spirit and the flesh is to be found in Plato, and was emphasized by the Neoplatonists. It is important in the teaching of St. Paul, and it dominated the Christian asceticism of the 4th and 5th centuries. Catholic philosophy is divided into two periods by the Dark Ages, during which in Western Europe intellectual activity was almost non-existent. From the conversion of Constantine to the death of Boethius, the thoughts of Christian philosophers are still dominated by the Roman Empire, either as an actuality or as a recent memory. The barbarians in this period are regarded merely as a nuisance, not as an independent part of Christendom. There is still a civilized community in which all well-to-do people can read and write, and a philosopher has to appeal to the laity as well as to the clergy. Between this period and the Dark Ages, at the end of the 6th century, stands Gregory the Great, who regards himself as a subject of the Byzantine Emperor, but is lordly in his attitude to barbarian kings. After his time, throughout Western Christendom, the separation of clergy and laity becomes more and more marked.